Basically, we are fishermen, not official people, so we fish for the truth. But the thing is that our nets are always relational to us as human beings. So these theories, their own work, and if they're our own work, they are as fallible as we are in human beings, even if they appear to be very, very accurate representations of reality.
Listen. Thanks for everyone for coming on, and I appreciate that it's it's the tail end of the academic semester trimester for you guys. So I appreciate you're bloody busy. Alan's shaking his head. Yeah, right. I appreciate you right in the middle. I appreciate you guys are busy, so like taking 45 minutes to indulge us. We do really, really appreciate it. But I also recognise that it's a conversation that's probably been needing to be had for a while, or at least put out into the public sphere. What we'll do is, everybody got the email today, but we'll start off as we always do, just by providing a little bit of an introduction.
Yeah, sure. So my name is Niels. I am Danish originally, and I did my PhD at Liverpool John Moores on organizational culture. Have primarily published on power relations and authority in organizational culture in British elite sports, but also on destructive cultures in British elite sports. And now I'm a postdoctoral researcher at Norwegian University of Science and Technology in Trondheim, where I carry out research on organizational culture, governance, sports management, and also the psychological impact of different adverse behaviors.
Awesome. I think we'll be drawing on some of that certainly in this episode. Thanks, Niels. Simon, we'll come to you.
My name's Simon Phelan. I'm a senior lecturer at Oxford Brookes University, where I work on the sport coaching degree. A bit like Niels, I come from a kind of a organizational culture background, but from a sociological kind of perspective, where I look at, I suppose, the impact of organizational culture on coach learning and the development of professional knowledge. So we have a slightly different slant on it, but perhaps come from the same kind of bigger umbrella picture sort of worldview. I do a decent amount of coach development and kind of consultancy outside of my academic sport. And I used to be an athlete, so I'm an athlete turned coach turned academic. And it's lovely to be back.
Thanks, Simon. And I could refrain from asking how you're feeling again tonight, but I definitely won't do that.
Craig was very happy with that.
Laurie slapping her head in the face with a book. Alan, keen to bring you in, buddy, if you want to introduce yourself.
Yeah, my name's Alain. I'm Swiss, live in Germany for 5 years, I think now. I'm a first year master's student, and I had to look it up. What's it called in English? It's intelligence and motion. And I've recently started coaching distance runners, unfortunately only online so far. I hope that will change next year. And yeah, I'm looking forward to this.
Given a couple of weeks ago, there was what can only be described as a fairly divisive debate that unfolded on Twitter, one that I very much got myself wrapped up in and drawn into. I was keen to perhaps pull together three people who reached out as a consequence, perhaps, of what they saw. Now, Alan, quite rightly, when a conversation descended into something that became very unproductive, held us to account. So we invited Alan on as a consequence of that. The Saturday morning, I believe, Niels, you reached out to me just to discuss what on earth is going on. So we invited you on to discuss where that was coming from. And Simon, we had a chat on the Monday after everything unfolded, just to discuss again what was going on, but perhaps what is the impact on sports coaching researchers and on the narrative around academia in sport coaching, full stop. So who'd like to kick us off with some comments, some thoughts, some reflections on perhaps why you reached out, why you engaged as a result of that debate.
Yeah, I can start. I started following this debate, I think Thursday, a couple of weeks ago. And I then spoke to Simon actually on the Friday, and we were just discussing the debate. Simon and I were talking about a paper that we're writing together, but we always start with some just a loose chat. And the main thing that came up was there was the debate that was going on Twitter. And I'm a young researcher, and I have been less wise and engaged in such a debate earlier, and made a snide comment, which I was surprised at myself making, but I felt it quite stressful being wrapped up in a debate like that. So Simon and I were talking about other young researchers who were in this debate and what the impact was and how they were doing, and how they might feel psychologically, mentally from the debate. And then I think I messaged you and to say that, wow, it looks like a spicy debate that you're in right now. And again, reached out on Saturday to check in with how you're doing. And because I started thinking about this the impact, the psychological impact of these debates on Twitter. And I thought that I hadn't seen the same kind of divisive discourse before. It was something new, something that has kind of emerged over the last 6 months. And it might be that I haven't been paying attention before, but my mind kind of went to this stress that everyone's under enormous stress at the moment with the lockdowns, with the pandemic, and we might not feel it. So people who've been thriving yesterday might have a hard time today. And all of this stress might lead to having a shorter fuse, a little bit less graciousness, a little bit less taking the high road, a little bit less understanding, a little bit less asking questions rather than combative. Of course, Twitter it's a very bad medium for having long, productive conversations, being, was it 240 characters or something. So it is hard just as a medium. But I was really considering how people felt mentally and how it might affect feelings of anxiety or unproductive stress in a lot of young researchers. And it's also in the back of these, one of the biggest grants in the UK recently made just a survey of all their researchers, and they found that 78% of the researchers felt like the working conditions are unkind and aggressive, and actually upwards of 53% of researchers have sought help for depression or anxiety. And this is prior to the pandemic. So this stress is already in research, and now we have these divisive discussions on Twitter, and how is this fueling the fire? And that was really where I was coming from, yeah, reaching out.
Thanks. Yeah, that's an interesting stat. 53% of researchers sought help for anxiety, and did you use the word depression there? As a consequence of perhaps the culture in around academia as a young researcher, is that?
Well, working conditions, being unkind and aggressive are the main things. There's also the same survey also highlighted a lack of trust, that the 2 out of 3 researchers are not comfortable reporting bullying or harassment in research. 75% of researchers doubt that appropriate steps will be taken. And of course, this is very much in research, in individual research institutions, organizations, universities. So it is slightly different. And I'm very much coming at this as a researcher and a young researcher, and less as a coach developer, because I was a spectator to this conversation, because I don't know much about skill acquisition or either of the camps or where it was. So I was coming into the debate every night, figuring out who are these people that I hadn't heard about before, and I realized have done a lot of work. And the thing is, I pretty much believe that most people are good fathers, they're good friends, they're good mothers, they're good colleagues, they're good partners. So what is it that makes good people have this short fuse? Those were some of my thoughts.
Yeah, thanks. And perhaps to share some of the reflections that we had in that conversation, that we never know what's going on beyond the screen that's interacting with social media, interacting with us. And we talk about some of the problems that people have within their lives, that perhaps social media becomes dehumanized in a way that it's an opportunity for people to vent. So whatever's pent up and whatever's sat inside them that they're dealing with, and bear in mind we're in the middle of a pandemic just now, that it's an easy outlet for people to fall out of character and perhaps lash out in a way that is not necessarily representative of who they are as a human being. And again, I found myself getting lost in that debate, and I made some comments that were pretty patronizing to people that I would never do within the sphere of my professional life or even in my personal life. And so what is it about social media that made me do that? And I go back to my motives for engaging in the debate first and foremost. And I think it started with when I feel that there's something unfair or untoward towards somebody I know and somebody I respect, then my natural inclination is to lean in and support some of that narrative. And perhaps on reflection, I should have just held off. Because the other bit that we talked about, Niels, was this idea that people have got skin in the game. And some of this debate becomes quite existential. And so naturally, people are going to be quite emotional and emotive in and around that. We do recognize that there are other people that engage in that debate that do act in such a way on both sides of the divide that could be construed as being rather emotional by virtue of the fact that they have, as I said, skin in the game. Alan, I'm keen to just come to you next, if that's okay, because you felt compelled to hold Andrew and I to account. And it was a really interesting, the way in which you framed it. And you almost like, well, you stopped me in my tracks. And I think after that point, I just stopped engaging in the debate. What compelled you to do that?
I don't think there was like one moment or one tweet that made me do it. It was just, I have to start with like the whole weekend, there were lots of threads, right? On skill acquisition, Andrew posted a couple threads. Why he thinks it's a good idea to stick to one theory, which I didn't necessarily agree, but they were interesting and controversial. So then at some point, I don't know how exactly that happened. You kind of chimed in, right? And retweeted what one of Andrew's tweets, I don't know which one it was, and basically called him, what was it? An ultra crepidarian. He's a scientist. He did, let's say, advise coaches to stick to one theory. And actually he said it's, I don't know, I forgot his exact words. I think it was not stupid coaching, but it went in that direction to stick to one theory. So I can understand why you thought, okay, that's not all right. But yeah, then you reacted in a way, and then he reacted to that. And obviously it's just, you were both pissed off, I'd say. And I thought, how did that happen? I mean, it was interesting, the discussions, and they were, yeah, controversial, but that's okay. And that's a good thing, actually. So then it kind of escalated, and that was, I thought about what my feelings were. And On one hand, I was a bit frustrated because so many good discussions between people who actually want the same thing. They just go in directions that nobody wants, and there's fights that no one wants to lead that are completely unnecessary. I was a bit annoyed because what were you trying to prove and to whom? Several people involved. And actually, I was curious. I mean, why did you do that? Why did you, what made you write that? What did you want to achieve and what were your intentions with it? So I decided to just write down what I felt was right and see how you would react. And I hoped you wouldn't take it the wrong way because, I was trying to be constructive, but it's always difficult in emotionally loaded discussions. So, that's one thing I'm still curious about, actually. What compelled you to write those tweets and what were you trying to achieve?
It's a good question. The honest answer at the time, I don't know what I was trying to achieve. I suppose I was to be told that as somebody who's coached for 10 years and worked with developing coaches for roughly around the same time, that the knowledge that you've acquired as a consequence of that experience that you've had, those mistakes that you've made, the scars that you bear as a consequence of getting your hands fairly dirty, that your ideations, your notions of your conceptions of what coaching are wrong, is pretty tough to take. And I found it even tougher when I asked the simple question, have you ever coached? And to have such a challenge from somebody and such an opinion on coaching full stop from somebody who hasn't coached before, at that point I just felt I was kind of a bit taken back by it, if I'm being honest. And the way in which people were perhaps put down, or perspectives were put down, or were told, you're either all in on a perspective or you're not in at all. Even though it's a perspective that I draw upon and adopt in certain aspects of how I coach, I just felt kind of let down by that side of the divide, if that makes sense. And so my natural inclination was to perhaps just lash out. And was that productive for anybody? Absolutely not. To answer your question, I don't know what I was trying to achieve, but I perhaps didn't achieve anything at all. Simon, you've got your hands up. You want to come in?
Yeah, only just because we've kind of started talking about the Twitter as a vehicle, and kind of my immediate reactions at the time were, oh crap, should I be involved in this? Like, is this the type of game I should be playing as someone who wants to be an academic in this space, someone who wants to be a coach developer, someone who wants to do stuff in this field, this space? And then that sudden kind of imposter syndrome of, I don't think I can. Like, one, I don't think I could, one, be divisive and sneaky, and I'm not good enough at arguing, I don't think, in that way, in terms of tying people in knots or shouting loudest. And two, I also don't think I believe anything to the nth degree where I would live and die on a particular hill. So I had kind of an initial, crap, maybe I don't know something good enough to be able to do this. But then I started thinking about the vehicle that is Twitter. And, I've never been particularly good at writing, 140 characters or 280, whatever it is, and being pithy and concise and kind of deep and meaningful and having lots of people love it and retweet it and whatever. And I go through phases of going, oh, I should be better at this. And then phases of going, it's pointless, I shouldn't. But kind of rightly or wrongly, the medium of social media, particularly Twitter at the moment, is the vehicle through which coaches are engaging with coaching and sport and practice. I think, you know, there's probably other, of course, like the BBC say, there's always other brands available. But, you know, myself and Anna are doing a bit of work at the moment. And a lot of the data is coming back saying that social media was fantastic because it kept me alive in terms of my coaching. I still felt like a coach. I could still engage and develop and go through CPD and talk to other coaches. So coaches now find themselves with lots of time and lots of opportunity. So these vehicles are, rightly or wrongly, again, something they're grabbing hold of. So I think the stuff we put out on those vehicles then becomes even more powerful because the message all of a sudden is reaching perhaps far more and perhaps being taken on by far more. And maybe coaches who might not otherwise have engaged with it or engaged with social media are coming across these messages. And, you know, it was just one of those things. And that's immediately why I think I reached out, was because I felt that immediate challenge myself as an academic, but then also that fear of, well, what are the implications of this kind of going down the line for the hundreds of thousands, or, you know, I might be naive, but of coaches who are suddenly going to this online space going, I want to stay engaged, and then seeing kind of challenging conversations like this. If I felt scared, challenged, unsure, what would someone else feel like who perhaps wasn't from that space?
Yeah, I just want to build on that, really, because what we see a lot in social media in general is sort of a deterministic discourse where everything is either, it's very quite binary, it's black or white. And it's not just in coaching, it's in psychology, in sports psychology, and in some of the cases we're seeing around the world, that either you're in or out, for or against. It's very deterministic, it's not dualistic, there's no room for nuance or gray space. Sometimes, of course, there is sometimes, I've had some really productive chats too on Twitter. And one of the things I came across the same weekend by complete coincidence was a hugely divisive figure in psychology, this Canadian psychologist, and I think it's fair enough to say his name because he is a public figure, Jordan Peterson, who is quite divisive. He's very much against using any other gender pronouns than he or she. There's no room for queer or trans or they or them. And he was on a podcast with Russell Brand, and I was just quite impressed by the way that Russell Brand approached that conversation, because I've only known Russell Brand as a comedian, and seeing him sit there and say, well, I guess this is where I disagree with you, but can you tell me a bit more about how you see level of discourse? And that's probably one of the things that this Twitter as a vehicle, like Simon said, is how do we get that side, or the positive side, like a vehicle to learn, to develop, and not become deterministic and be a bit more open. That's probably where what I'm thinking a lot about at the moment.
Where are all the referees on Twitter? Where are the people who sit in the middle and go, it's a fair question, right? Because it just feels, if I'm honest, right, I don't think that I'm in the cognition camp. I'm not all in one perspective or the other. I like to flirt between the two. And sometimes when you ask questions on either side of the divide, you can actually get lumbered in or locked in or labeled as being one or the other, which I don't really like. But all you're trying to do is just follow a line of inquiry based on the curiosity that you've got around a subject area. But be really interested to understand who are the referees out there, who are the ones that really are just sat in the middle.
Yeah, there's kind of two things. One, I did jokingly talk about creating an account called the Academic Referee, and just like giving yellow cards to people for personal references, giving people, you know, putting up memes of, you know, improper evidence, using anecdotes, and basically kind of being that jokey. I just thought, as funny as it sounds, it's not worth it. But then, kind of going off what Nils was just saying, kind of going to make was, no one wins Twitter. really. Like, I always joke, you don't get a blue badge if you suddenly win an argument in Twitter. You know, you might say that the person who gets the most likes and has the biggest audience wins. But I think the vehicle that is Twitter is itself challenging because it doesn't inspire someone to go, do you know what? You're right. It doesn't inspire someone to stop the conversation or the argument, because what you have is a permanent audit trail that lives forever in the social world of, this is person X who lost, who stopped responding, who didn't respond to the 15 comments that challenged them and called them wrong. So I think it encourages us to continue to push back, because there is no kind of definitive point. Another thing that I've heard people do, and I, you know, I've seen conversations between big academics in our space and people going, you're not answering my question. Like, I'm asking you this, but you're not answering my question. And I think a lot of that is they're not talking to you. They're talking to their following. What they're doing is they're validating their position quite often by putting a message out there for 1,500 people to like and retweet, as opposed to talking to the person they're having a discussion with. So it's not necessarily listening to respond. It's basically listening just to put out my message again and again and again. And I think, again, that comes down to the power that is Twitter. It isn't how good the response is. It's how many people then react to it. And you can see those statistics, your reactions based on a tweet.
Yeah, I think one of the questions I ask myself, I find myself asking most often when on Twitter, is why is this person on Twitter? What's their goal? Are they there to entertain, to get more followers, to find people who buy their product? Are they on Twitter to learn? Because that's what I'm on Twitter for. I want to learn from scientists, from coaches, from people with experience and with, well, with something to say that's new to me. But I can't expect everybody to be open to questions, because some just want to show what they put out, and they don't want to be questions, and they don't want feedback. So I have to accept that. But still, I mean, when someone's on there to just be a bit of a dick, yeah, and someone else is on there to learn and to show off, there has to be conflict, and we usually don't know why they're on.
I'm deliberately staying relatively quiet, because mainly I'm just interested to hear your perspectives of the guests that are on, and thank you. Also, I'm in a bit of a confused space, because I have joined social media for the first time in my life this year. Although in the lead up to that, probably for maybe a year and a half now, I've definitely been going on and really value the contributions, like Alan, of a lot of the people, you know, that come to social media to share. And I do really value that. But I think the relationship with my attention at the moment is a difficult one. And I think we are a product of people. We, you know, we're using Twitter. We're just a product. People are, you know, they've got us hook, line and sinkered. And I think it's a really scary space to be in. I think it selects for poor behavior. And I think we're seeing a lot of that. You know, what's fueling it? Well, the dopamine hit of your phone pinging and somebody responding to a question or a comment that you've made. So I'm in a really confused space. But equally, you know, from a really personal level, I've got two kids, so it's really great to be understanding undoubtedly what they're going to be experiencing when they are inevitably on these platforms. But to go back to my initial point, I really value a lot of the contributions that people make, and I have learned a lot from the people that use the platform. So it's difficult. How do we navigate that?
Yeah, I think I want to come on onto all what both Simon, Alan, and Laurie were talking about, and kind of coming from this, who are the referees? And I quite frankly think that having a spoof account sounds really fun, but having referees on social media might not be the right way. I know that we have on certain forums on Facebook and Reddit, we have moderators who can kick people out. And the darker corners of the web, 4chan, 8chan, there are no moderators, and my God, the debate is hefty sometimes. But right now I'm researching or looking into something called cultural hegemony, And it's basically the thought that you have a ruling class that sets out the parameters, or they create the rules for how to co-create or produce cultural meaning in an organization or in a group of people or in a social class. So I think going on and trying to become the referees of Twitter is possibly not the way, because you might see that the referees also have skin in the game and they start to elevate one perspective over another. But I will say that, like, there's people who I draw upon on their research because they have made some stellar research, and they inspire me when I'm in my research bubble. But I have opted not to follow them or stop following them on social media because the tone changes my perspective on their research. And I hate that, because I value some of the research at such a high level, but then when I start connecting some of the things, it disrupts it for me. So the people I respect a lot as researchers, I focus them on as researchers, and I try not to engage so much with some of those people. And it's like, it's not in a certain space. It's quite wide. I draw on general psychology, anthropology, a lot of research around college sports in the US. So
coming back to you, Niels, and your background in culture, and you too, Simon, it's pretty obvious that the bubble that engages in this debate isn't very big. It's not very wide. And we've all been in our own cultures, which at times are fairly self-policing. So the participants in it tend to set or create or adhere to some acceptable boundaries and thresholds within the context of that culture. And I think some of those boundaries and thresholds were bent and in some cases broken. And again, I'm complicit in that over the course of that weekend. But what was nice is that there was an element of that, of self-policing within that, ergo the example of Alan reaching out and sending that tweet. So in the spirit of a self-policing culture, is there anything that we can do to foster that or cultivate that within the context of that broader debate within Twitter?
I can jump on and tell you what I did when I made a very ill-advised comment. And I just said sorry right after. I felt it that I, when I had done it, and then it just lived there in perpetuity. And yeah, I just, in my next tweet as a comment to that, I just said, yeah, I know that I went a bit too far there. I'm sorry about that. I am by no means infallible or perfect, or I haven't discovered the silver bullet to these issues, but I tried to just show some grace. And I was also called out by a pal in the not public direct messages. And I appreciated that comment too. And just having that conversation and saying, yeah, my bad. That was a bad ill-advised comment.
No, for sure, because I'm imagining, similar to me, you're probably not aware of that. Or not perhaps aware of the headspace that you're in at that point when you click send, right? Sometimes you're aware of the impact, but sometimes I think you're just lost in it.
Yeah, I was just thinking, I mean, most of the conversation now kind of focused on what individuals do, but oftentimes, especially with the whole conversation on skill acquisition, there's actually those, I don't know whether they're real camps or they're just perceived as camps, but a lot of the time when one of those perceived camps, when one individual maybe says or does things that are not very good, I'm lacking the words here, do we actually perceive the whole group as questionable, I mean, via the the group attribution camp error, I think it's called, right?
This is a real handout this time. Yeah, I think this kind of speaks to the idea that we tend to stereotype people as human beings because it makes life easier. We've always done it because we like to reduce things down into easily manageable things so we can kind of reduce the complexity of the social world, and that's fine. However, a bit like kind of Alan said, I think as human beings, we're inherently territorial. We find something we like and we grab hold of it. And then we talked about it in the previous or one of the other episodes around culture, about the echo chambers we live in. If we live in echo chambers surrounded by people who tell us we're good, we're right, we're thinking great things, that we're probably closer to the answer than anyone else, then it is understandable to perhaps initially feel like, oh, someone's attacking me. And our response, you know, as a species, is to push back and to attack back. It's the don't think of a pink elephant, you think of a pink elephant kind of analogy a little bit. But I also think that we can perhaps explore what happens after that and start to support the community beyond that so that they can have the space to put their hands up and to do what Neil said to do, go, actually, I might have got that wrong. Actually, that might have been an emotive response. And that's okay, because human beings have emotional responses. We're not robots. Again, Anna reminded me of a paper recently that was actually written by my supervisor around volunteer coaches' kind of intentionality and their learning dispositions going into any CPD activity. And it was around intentionality and reciprocity, which basically means how open are you going into a certain context to hear the arguments of others, and how open are you to then engage in those kind of shared generative discussions. And I think when people think they are open to debate, they're not necessarily truly open to discussion. They're open to the opportunity to show they're right, as opposed to be challenged. If we can create a community where I can go in as someone from a cultural perspective who values certain things, but be open to the fact that someone might convince me I'm wrong, or that there might be a better way of talking about it, then that's very different to me going and going, I'm going to have this discussion because I'm going to convince them I'm right. And that's the only viewpoint they're going to take. So I think it's worth asking, what is the intentionality of people engaging in Twitter? And can, as a community, we start to shape that? You know, I think, as you know, my concern was with coaching as an academic study and coaching from an academic practitioner space was, well, can we cultivate a community that is open to that, you know, that many viewpoints perspective? I might have something I like and I hang my hat on and that I love, but am I open to discussing and being convinced? Because if you're not, then you're already having that kind of narrow, shallow viewpoint.
Yeah, I love that point you make, Simon, around community. And that will require there to be unwritten rules and for people, as Alan did, to hold one another to account. Despite my scepticism around social media and genuine nervousness engaging in it, there is a community there that people are clearly seeking out. And as well, at a really fundamental level, we all clearly love sport. And there's probably, in what is a lonely time for a lot of people, a lot of joy in debating about things that they're passionate about. You know, so it's really easy to be critical, right? Actually, there's some real, genuine, honest, good in what people are doing on there at points, I think, I have no doubt.
I would just say that links back to the stuff that we've already talked about before a number of times now, actually. That Entwistle and Peterson thing, which I revisited again recently and remembered how good that paper is. And Andy Abraham talked about it on one of our previous episodes as well. Just that kind of dualistic view of knowledge, maybe trying to move people on a little bit and understand that there's different viewpoints and you should come to your own reasoned perspective based on evidence and be able to, be open to challenge of that viewpoint based on the fact that you could then sort of get a more sophisticated kind of understanding of it, and that model kind of looks at people's conceptions of knowledge but also their conceptions of learning, and I suppose that probably links to the motivation to be on Twitter or what. And I looked at it recently because I was writing a book chapter about myths in sport coaching and sports coach education, and thinking that could be quite cool if we just teach coaches a little bit more about how to learn and how to maybe think about how they approach information in this way, rather than just thinking, you know, it comes from, you know, knowledge from authorities, or people seen as authorities on Twitter. It must be right or it must be wrong. Well, it must be right, I guess, if they're authorities. Sort of moving on to coming to your own sort of reasoned perspective and be able to back that up with some form of evidence.
That's a beautiful point, Anna. Simon, we'll come to you next. But it reminds me of a conversation Laurie and I have had on a number of occasions now, which is this notion of indoctrination. And I'm not saying that's what happens, right? But it's this real short-sightedness around having a perspective that you're going to stay in, which is perfectly fine. But to then state that your perspective is right and all other perspectives are wrong is the thing that really, really starts to agitate me and triggers me into perhaps getting involved in some of those debates. And it's reflected not just in the weekend just gone, but perhaps a couple of weeks ago where I publicly called somebody out for saying that or privileging a quote within an interview they did that one perspective was right or this is the right way and essentially inferring that all other ways are wrong. And it leans into that notion, Anna, that our role as educators of coaches or developers of coaches is not necessarily to present the knowledge itself, but support coaches to understand what is knowledge full stop. That it isn't something that is black and white or right and wrong, but it's definitely something that is perhaps provisional, to lean into Ed Whistle and Peterson's work, or completely relativistic. So it's really around what works for who and what context and why, certainly from a coaching perspective, which is my view. And I recognize that view is also fallible. And I suppose that's where I start getting my backup is that I'm perfectly fine with saying I'm wrong or my view is fallible. I think sometimes within the discourse, people with authority present their view as right without necessarily also caveating that with their view is fallible.
So I mean, Twitter doesn't help though, does it? Because it's, we've talked about this already.
Yeah.
No, I was just going to kind of, actually, Derek, you kind of teed it up really nicely that one of the main concerns I had of someone who kind of loves studying coaching and this academic space was that kind of some of the partisan positions that were taking during the debate, they seem to undermine an awful lot of what has been said about the nature of coaching from all of the people that I love. And again, it might come back to my biases as an academic and kind of the sociological space that I've moved within. But in terms of it went against the notion that, you know, coaching is both dynamic and complex and socially constructed. And, you know, as Andy said in one of the other episodes, it may require relative pragmatism. But it also challenges, I think, some of the positions that we're taking, it challenges or the notion of how theory might be used within the field, within this both an academic perspective and a practitioner perspective, and the notion that in this instance, we had two camps. And I think that two camps that didn't necessarily speak the same language. So I don't think they were actually ever really speaking about the same thing in terms of, you know, evidence for one in group or individual that was representing a group or deemed to represent a group might mean something completely different to the other side. So my worry comes from the proposition that theory, as you rightly say, is infallible. And again, it belays my kind of own philosophical position, but, you know, I'm going to lean on Karl Popper's work. And the only reason I'm doing it is because one of the other episodes, David Pickett reminded me of when I did my PhD, I went massively down into the philosophical rabbit hole. And Popper, I use this as a justification where in my PhD viva, someone went, "You're massively eclectic. Justify it. Justify why you're hanging your hat on so many kind of theoretical positions and what the value is in doing that in this kind of dilute perspective." And I kind of lent on Popper's suggestion, and it's a really quite poetic one. He suggests that scientific theories are basically human inventions. They're nets designed to catch the world, which is beautiful, lovely. Basically, we are fishermen or fisher people, so we fish for the truth. But the thing is that our nets are always relational to us as human beings. So these theories, their own work, and if they're our own work, they are as fallible as we are in human beings, even if they appear to be very, very accurate representations of reality. if we recognize that human beings are infallible, because they can put out a tweet and 10 seconds later go, crap, that was a mistake, then surely our theories of the world can be infallible, even if they're designed in a lab. Because ultimately, there's a human being looking at that data going, this is what this means. And that was something that kind of jumped out to me and was my one of my main concerns was, are we telling the world that within the academic study of coaching, theories are infallible?
That's a mic drop moment there, if there ever was one, right? We're going to start moving towards wrapping up. So, Alan, do you want to come in with just some final thoughts, if that's okay?
Yeah, but obviously they can't quite compare to what Simon said. Because, I mean, Popper, well, so I was thinking about two things, actually, two things I'm trying to do when I'm on Twitter. And one thing is I'm trying to be curious about whether I agree or disagree with someone. I try to be curious, okay, what compelled them to write what they wrote? And I'm generally always assuming they mean well. If you assume they mean well and they write something you disagree with, and you really try to think, okay, why might they have thought it's a good idea to write that, meaning well? That's, you can even either ask yourself or ask them. I mean, you might learn something about somebody else's view, which is always, I think that's great. I mean, that's one of the main reasons I'm on Twitter, to learn, to see the world from someone else's view. And the other thing is, and I really don't remember where I read it, but it's a tip, which is, don't write anything you wouldn't be proud to show to your mother.
You can spot the two Irishmen laughing at you writing that, because we've got strange relationships with our mothers in Ireland. So yeah, definitely you wouldn't want to put anything out on Twitter that you wouldn't want your mother to see.
Never upset mammy.
Never upset mammy. But I think Alan, that's a lovely gift that you've given us, almost a degree of Falconian self-surveillance, and a question that might pop into your mind in advance of sending out a tweet. So what's compelling you to send this tweet? Why are you just about to write that? Yeah, perhaps something I should have in the back of my mind every time I press compose now on Twitter, right? Niels, have you got anything to add to these parting gifts?
No, I'll just say that I hope that the stuff that Simon just said, what he's just written on our collective paper is as good, that he's going to go straight through revisions, no problems.
Sorry.
We're the new review board for the paper.
Yeah. Niels, if there was one thing that you could change about the discourse, what would it be?
That's a quick fire question, isn't it? Very slow answer. I think if there's anything I would change is probably building on what Alain and Simon said. It's how you argue your point. Do you argue your work, or do you use microaggressions or invalidate a person's point of view? It's something we often see, especially in politics, that you condemn the person with a point and saying, well, that guy's a Republican, that guy's a Democrat, and therefore their point is moot for me. So yeah, a bit more graciousness toward the person, but I think Alan and Simon said it better.
I think Niels has kind of captured something that I've felt for a long time and not necessarily been able to put into words, and it's, do we recognize that we can take value from people who we don't agree with? You know, I might disagree with someone's philosophical position fundamentally, but if they say something that is valuable and can have a positive impact on whatever context I'm working in, am I capable of recognizing that? And I would hope I am, and I think we should try to create a community or emancipate a community that can do that.
And just briefly to go back to that earlier point, given the amount of attention that skill acquisition has got within the discussions that we're referring to, I wonder, within coaching environments of the people involved in perhaps reading or engaging in those discussions, how much they prioritize skill acquisition and what they notice, what they plan for, what they engage in, the discussions they have. And is that appropriate for the people they're involved in supporting and developing?
Simon, is that a real or a fake? Hand up.
That's from last time. Unless my computer keeps throwing up hands trying to kill me.
Was this you at school? You just...
I was the person that
like that. Have you seen them patch Adams? Yeah.
But that's what it used to be like in Ireland. You'd have to put your hand up and say, Avuntor, Avuntor. But also what still stuck in my mind is Umwel Cadigam Dolgadi on Leheris Marsh of the Holly, which is, can I go to the toilet, please? I still can't get that turn of phrase in Osquilga out of my head. I know that Anna is going to want to get us off the call. But I think to respond to your point, Laurie, and I think it's noted in my last points that I was trying to make on Twitter, which is that skill acquisition informs some of the coaching process, but not the totality of the coaching process. It's a theory of something, not a theory of everything. But we do seem to feel, or I feel, smothered by that debate at the moment, and it seems to kind of wrap all of coaching into what is just a small aspect of it. And you're right, anybody that's coming in to learn about sport coaching at the moment who's engaging with that bubble might assume that coaching is skill acquisition and skill acquisition alone. And I think we just need to remind people of the fact that coaching is complex and it's a lot broader than just skill or motor development. Anna, timekeeper, I'm sorry.
You wouldn't do it in a coaching session.
I would actually. I was always bad for going over time. I'm not a fan of these 3 minute or 6 minute slots.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, she's just cut me down again.
No, I was just going to say, like, I don't really know because I didn't read the debates on Twitter because I just thought it was pointless. but I imagine it sounds like it got pretty personal, like people critiquing the person rather than actually what they were trying to say or the point they were trying to make. So, and I kind of get that in academic terms as well, like just critique the work or critique the point they're trying to make rather than the person, and try and receive that in the same way. Like if someone critiques your work, they're critiquing your work, not who you are, your worth as a person. So yeah, that would be the only thing that I have to add.
Yeah, this was a thing I thought about but forgot before, but this notion of knowing when to say stop, but also thinking, actually, I don't like the energy in the conversation right now. If we'll keep going on down this road, fine, but it's not going to be with me. If we can take it this way, I'll be pretty happy. And again, I witnessed this on a podcast where they tried to catch an industry leader out because of some things he had put on a poker forum 15 years ago. They kept returning to it, and he just calmly said, I don't like where the energy of the conversation is going right now. If I have to justify things or defend things that happened 15 years ago, I don't think that's where the conversation should go. I would rather talk about these areas. And I found that immensely powerful in a way, both the way he directed the conversation, and maybe it was because he is a powerful CEO, but also a way of showing kind of a cognitive surplus in that you have a bit extra ideas and can say, it's a great discussion. I just don't think this energy is workable, or it works for me. Let's try another direction.
I think we found the point at which things are being cut.
and on the cut bit, Niels, I think the best thing I've got from Twitter was a playlist that you recommended a long time ago by a pianist. What is his name? It begins with an E.
Ludovico Einaudi.
Thank you. Yeah, great. Honestly, that was the best thing I've had from Twitter so far.
What playlist is this?
Can you read?
It's an Italian composer, Ludovico Einaudi. Yeah, I think I listen to it at least a few times a week. It's just very relaxing.
I can't compete with this, Nils. You've won, all right? Stop.
Yeah, this is probably where like my highbrow academic self comes out. All I do is read Foucault and eat foie gras and listen to Ludovico Einaudi and maybe Sweet Sancerre on the side. I don't think this should be in the podcast, but no. But Ludovico Einaudi, I enjoy it.
It feels like I'm watching a throwback to Frasier, and it's like Niles and Frasier on the call. We actually have a real Niles.
Exactly.
Simon, are you playing the role of Frasier? Is that what's going on?
I think I've
the older brother.
I feel like I've come off well in that one.
Yeah, it is.
You've got considerably more hair than Frasier.
I know. Right when I started my PhD, actually, I was supposed to do it with rugby union or a football club here in the Northwest. But one of my mentors, who I've learned so much from, he just said, Niels, you're too middle class. You can never do anything in football. Not knowing that I played in a football academy and I was just stumped. It was so funny.
I love it. Lean into it. I go into football contexts and start using terrible phrases like diags, and they just see right through me and think it's brilliant when this kind of skinny Irish man is trying to talk about football.
Yeah.
Do you talk about football in inverted commas when you go into those clubs as well?
Oh, I say,
we call it soccer in Ireland. So what's this football show?
I say when you're on the grass with the lads talking about passing and things, and I'm sitting there. I spent every major decision I made up to age 26 was about jumping over a bar, so I've got no leg to stand on.
You start singing, we're all part of Jackie's army, and we're all off to Italy, and we'll really shake them up when we win the World Cup because Ireland have the greatest football team. Ole, 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 ole.
That's embedded in my. We used to drive to Kiltearnan, where I learned to swim, and there was a house painted in green, white, and orange with Give It a Lash, Jack, and I'll never forget it. Drive past it every day.
I think it's time for us to say thank you and goodbye. It's descending. But yeah, no, it does leave us to say thank you to Alan, Simon and Niels for giving up your time on a Tuesday evening to sit in Spraff and talk to us about what we felt and I felt to be an important subject to discuss and try and make sense of. So yes, thank you guys very much for giving up your time and engaging. It's no tradition for me to ask Anna if she's got any parting gifts.
No, I think I used up all of my gifts.
That's GIFs, not GIFTS.
Yeah, I also used up the gifts. I've sent those in the chat. I sent a GIF. A gift, GIF.
Oh Christ, we better get off the call.